This is Ron Orle, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking to Lauren Gojkovic, founder and managing member of LDG Advisory, an advisory firm that counsels engaged investors on high-stakes activist investments. Before launching her own firm, Lauren was a managing director and head of PJT Partners' U.S. Activist Defense Practice in New York, and she joined PJT when it acquired Camberview Partners. And before that, she was VP Assistant General Counsel in the Corporate Governance Group at Goldman Sachs Legal Division, focused on corporate governance for Goldman Sachs' boards. That must have been quite interesting. Before that, she worked at Wachtell Lipton, the top activist defense law firm, where she focused on M&A, proxy fights, and takeover defense. So quite a background. Welcome, Lauren, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ron. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, so immediately when I saw your background and what you're doing at LDG, I thought it was quite interesting. Tell me a little bit more about LDG Advisory and what kind of clients you work with. And my sense is at PJT, Camberview, Wachtell, you work more on the company side, you know, defending against activists, but now you're advising investors. Is that right? Why the change?
Yep, that's right. So I was on the defense side for over a decade, both on the legal side at Wachtell, and then on the financial advisory side at Camberview, and then PJT, where I led the U.S. activism defense practice. And why the change? That's a great question. Something I really loved about my work at Camberview was the deep emphasis and expertise that firm has on the investor perspective. And I came to Camberview from the more traditional advisory background with my time at Wachtell and Goldman. My first job out of college actually was on the trading desk at Goldman. But the team at Camberview is really comprised of the heads of the stewardship teams at all the largest asset managers and others from the contested situations teams at ISS and Glass Lewis. And in today's market, if you want to win a proxy fight, you just can't do it without understanding how to speak the language of those investors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's two other parts of my career that I really love. And the first is advising clients through those really challenging make or break moments. You know, it's a privilege to have my clients trust me to lead them through those times. And it's a level of trust I take very seriously. And secondly, I also just love shareholder activism. It's this wonderfully complicated mix of legal and business challenges with companies that are going through complicated transitions. And what I try to do for my clients is really bring that investor perspective and make sure that they're able to cut through the noise of these fights and remain laser focused on what ultimately is the one thing that matters, and that's winning the shareholder vote. So back to your question, kind of the original question, I guess, about, you know, why the change from the company to the investor side and why I launched LDG Advisory. So after over a decade on the defense side, I was ready for the next challenge career-wise. You know, I'm an intellectually curious person. I love podcasts like your podcast, Ron. And if I was honest with myself, it always seemed odd to me that I'd chosen as my life's work advising clients on activists, and I'd never actually worked alongside an activist. So in this twist of fate, I was catching up with one of the top lawyers in the market and sharing with him about the importance of this investor perspective that I used to shape my defense strategy. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, there are lots of activists out there that need that advice. You should start your own advisory business." And I thought to myself, that's nuts. I've, you know, been a lawyer. I've been a banker. I've never been an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Well, literally the next day, I was catching up with the general counsel at one of the market's most well-respected activist funds. And he shared with me that, you know, what he was thinking about for this proxy fight they were engaged in. And I gave him, you know, a few arguments and tactics I thought they should try. And he just turns to me and goes, "Well, can I hire you?" And I said, yes. And that's how LDG Advisory got started.
That's really interesting.
it was. I never saw it coming, really. But I'm so happy that he kind of had that faith in me and I kind of took that leap. And it was a pretty wild start. So I worked on some of the biggest proxy fights last spring, working with Sachem Head at US Foods, Alta Fox at Hasbro. And it really proved that this type of deep expertise on how to shape a client's thesis into a story that resonates across the shareholder base is incredibly valuable both to companies and to activists. And what I find so interesting now being on this kind of other investor side is that so often my investor clients are laser focused on the exact same issues that the stewardship teams find so fundamentally important. And those are issues like board composition, ensuring you have the right skill set to enable really robust oversight of management, governance practices that support the shareholder franchise, a deep distaste for actions from boards where it feels like there's some sense of entrenchment, and really a deeply held focus on creating long-term sustainable value. So when I'm working with my investor clients now in these contested situations, it's easy to make it feel authentic because at the end of the day, it really is authentic.
Now, that's really, really interesting because, you know, every now and then, as I've been following all the advisor community and the activist world, I see somebody that spent a long time advising companies against activists shift over to advising activists versus companies. And this one guy in particular I was thinking of, he then left after doing that. He then went and launched his own activist fund. And So I see that. I feel like, you know, your experience with working with institutional investors with the Camberview background and your Wachtell background is something that I think, you know, would be very useful for activist investors. So it's quite interesting to see and lots of success in the future. So, okay, I wanted to get into some of the hot topics of the activism world today. And of course, one of the top ones is the universal proxy card, which is kind of, in my opinion, driving a paradigm shift in the way companies and activists think about their contests. And for our audience who may not know exactly what it's all about, the SEC adopted rules, the Securities and Exchange Commission adopted rules that took effect in September that gave institutional investors more flexibility to pick and choose who they want among both incumbent and dissident slates. And before it was very difficult, for example, to pick, let's say you're an institutional investor, you wanted to pick 2 out of 4 dissident director candidates and you wanted to pick the remaining 8 incumbent directors. It was very difficult to do that. You had to vote on the activist proxy card or the company's proxy card, and you couldn't really mix and match exactly the way you wanted to. And now you really have more flexibility if you're an institutional investor. So, Lauren, you've broken down the issue of UPC into 3 constituencies. Mm-hmm. What do you mean for activist boards and the rest of the shareholder base? Explain.
Sure. And I have to say, it really would not be a podcast or discussion of the 2023 proxy season without mentioning the universal proxy card. That much is for sure. So let's see. So the 3 constituencies, you know, when I think about the UPC, I really think about it through those 3 lenses. And it's activists, it's boards of directors, and it's the rest of the voters in the shareholder base. And really, out of these 3 constituencies, the one that I believe is going to have the biggest impact on the outcomes as a result of the UPC is the board of directors. Talking about kind of the first 2 constituencies first, then we can turn to the board. For institutional investors, and even ISS and Glass Lewis, they've been very clear that the UPC doesn't really change their analysis or their vote framework. For activists, you know, they're still going to be looking for the best qualified nominees they can and target who on the board they believe is delivering the least amount of value on behalf of shareholders. I will say there's been a lot of talk about how the UPC ends the ability to do a majority slate campaign, but those are always a big challenge. And frankly, they're pretty few and far between.
Yeah, we don't see many change of control contests. Typically, it's like Carl Icahn seeking to take over a board and have an unsolicited bid to go with it. But you're right. We haven't seen many without the unsolicited bid. And so, yeah, probably that won't change anyways.
That's right. And so then you have that 3rd constituency I mentioned, which is what is going to happen with directors in the boardroom in this new environment with the UPC. And taking a step back, if you think about what the boardroom dynamics were under that old dual card regime, everyone knew which directors were being targeted and which directors were effectively safe. So you have a minority of the directors in the boardroom facing a really tough fight, potentially significant reputational risk. But you also have the rest of the board that's secure in knowing that they're not going to face those really potentially personal attacks of the fight. But for those directors, if there's a settlement, then they just may have to face the scrutiny of an activist watching them perform in the boardroom. So if you put aside a lot of the factors directors are considering in thinking about whether to fight or settle, and of course, abiding by their fiduciary duties is the main, most important factor. But putting that one aside, you know, under the old regime, it really teed up a get out of jail free card for directors who decided to move forward and take on the proxy fight. Because if you think about it, if they settled, the activist or their nominee would end up in the boardroom. If they fought, it was only the target directors that would take the heat. But if they fought and won, then these non-targeted directors would get through the proxy fight pretty much unscathed. So that was the decision tree for directors back under the old regime. Today, the UPC introduces a completely different calculus for directors. Now, any director on the board could conceivably face that reputational risk that used to only be faced by those specifically targeted directors. And I will say, to be fair, it does seem like in the early days here, activists are still targeting specific directors for removal. But I just feel like there's this greater sense of unease in boardrooms that anyone could be facing this heightened scrutiny. So where does this all lead to? I think it leads to just greater uncertainty in the boardroom. And boards and their advisors really don't love risk or unknowns. And so that greater sense of control and quicker timeline to resolution offered by a settlement agreement, I think that's going to mean we see settlements become more palatable and we see them a lot more often.
Now, that's really interesting because I was thinking about, you know, the different proxy contests that we've seen so far with the universal proxy card. And one, of course, that came to mind was Nelson Peltz and Tryon's blockbuster director contest at Walt Disney. Of course, canceled his contest after, they brought back Bob Iger and they did a huge layoffs of job cuts, a restructuring, set $5.5 billion in cost savings. But what I thought was really interesting is before he canceled his contest, Peltz targeted a particular director in his proxy material, Michael B.G. Froman, a vice chairman at MasterCard, and urged investors specifically to withhold their vote for him. Mm-hmm. And I know Froman is on the governance nomination committee, and I suspect Peltz wanted to be on that committee and involved in succession planning at Disney. Mm-hmm. But I felt that targeting him was a consequence of the universal proxy card. Is that fair? I mean, do you think we're going to see more activists targeting individuals to remove, or how do you think it'll work?
Yeah, well, I guess taking a step back first, with the UPC, we've now given shareholders kind of this carte blanche to pick and choose their candidates. And it's really a smorgasbord of options for investors. The problem for activists is that if other investors in the shareholder base, you know, pick a little of this and a little of that, then ultimately, given the way the vote map works, it's quite possible none of the activist nominees will consolidate sufficient vote support to win a seat. So what activists and other, let's call it activated investors are realizing is that you need to minimize that dilution vote risk. Or if you want to kind of continue that smorgasbord analogy, you need something to direct the broader shareholder base away from this pick and choose buffet line and just move them straight to the carving station. And one way for activists to do that is to make clear in their fight materials and on the actual proxy card itself, who they recommend shareholders vote against on the company side. And I think, you know, we've seen activists do that already this proxy season.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So I'm curious if you could talk a little about maybe one of the contests that we've seen using UPC. For example, we saw Land and Buildings, Jonathan Litt. He had some success at Aimco, a real estate company where one of his candidates got elected. Then there was Ron Bobman, kind of, I wouldn't consider him the most advanced activist, but he's an insurance investor and focused on Argo, which he ultimately withdrew just before that contest played out. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on the situation we've seen so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe taking a little bit of a different turn, a little bit away from the UPC here, or kind of an unforeseen consequence that I think is really notable of the Land and Buildings campaign. You know, there's something that happened at that Land and Buildings campaign that I think is really important, and I haven't seen many people talk about it yet. Taking like a little bit of a step back, you know, as background, it's pretty much universally accepted that for an activist to win a proxy fight, they need to win the support of both of the proxy advisory firms. So win the support of ISS and Glass Lewis. Mm-hmm. And yet here at that campaign with Jonathan Litt, his independent director nominee was elected with only the support of ISS. So Glass Lewis didn't support campaign. And that says to me two things. You know, the first thing is that, okay, maybe this starts to confirm what is, I'd call it the conventional wisdom out there, at least on the defense advisory side, that is that this UPC tool is going to result in more activist wins. Okay, maybe that's true, but it's still early days. The second point, and this is the one that no one has really predicted, is that maybe the UPC is going to result in ISS and Glass Lewis having less power to determine the outcomes in a proxy fight. I think that's super interesting and something that could be a bit of a game changer and an interesting commentary, I think, for about the shareholder franchise really kind of doing its job. Now, zooming out a bit, I do think the UPC is ultimately a good thing for investors writ large. It's going to raise the bar for director nominee quality on both sides. And at the end of the day, it really is an example of good governance driving better outcomes and hopefully better value for all shareholders.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that, that I didn't realize that Glass Lewis didn't support and you only got the backing from one of the two main proxy advisors. Yep. But what's interesting, so I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier on, which is that ISS and Glass Lewis have been very clear that UPC doesn't change their analysis or vote framework. And, you know, I'm sure that they say that, but I've always heard that, you know, that this UPC will make it easier for ISS or Glass Lewis to have more flexibility in making their recommendations and don't have to think about the unintended consequences of recommending on the dissident slate of losing some incumbent candidates that the ISS didn't want. But anyways, I don't know. I think it's interesting that Landon Building succeeded getting one of their directors elected there. I've been thinking a lot about ISS and Glass Lewis's influence lately. Particularly, I'm following this one activist situation at a fish oil heart drug company, Amarin, where the activist, Sarissa, is seeking to nominate seven directors on a 9-person board and nominate seven directors. It's basically a minority slate, but it would be seven dissidents, which is kind of unusual, 47% of the board. And anyways, ISS and Glass Lewis came out in favor of the company, and you think that that's a big advantage, but this company has only 32% institutional investors, which is very unusual. So it has a massive retail investor body. So anyways, you always think about most companies have much larger institutional investor bases. So therefore, I suspect that ISS and Glass Lewis have more influence. But anyways, my personal feeling is that ISS and Glass Lewis may be privately adjusting their thoughts on how they would make recommendations because they know that institutions have more flexibility in picking directors. So I don't know. Sort of additional thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I think you're very right about this fear of the unintended consequence. I mean, the framework for the proxy advisory firms is really, is there a case for change and who's best situated to affect that change? And sometimes I think in the mind's eye of the ISS and Glass Lewis teams, they see a need for change. They just don't think that it warrants as much change in terms of turning over board seats as the activist slate might be calling for. And so they were constrained just by kind of mechanics of the old regime, right? You, exactly as you said it, if you recommended on the activist card, they felt that in cases where there's change needed, but maybe not 100% change, they might have been a little bit more wary of recommending on the activist card because they didn't think it warranted putting every single one of the activist nominees on the company's side. So I think you are right in that this gives the proxy advisory firms more flexibility, but that fundamental framework that really shapes how they analyze these situations, I don't think that's going anywhere.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And it's interesting because I feel like the activist Sarissa, you know, that one of the things that ISS and Glass Lewis do is if you wanted a majority vote slate, so want to take control of a majority board, there's a higher threshold and ISS expects you to do more thorough presentation. So the activist Sarissa got around that, I think, by nominating seven directors, but offering to expand the board from 9 to 15. So there was still a minority slate of seven directors. So anyways, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out because I think that ISS and Glass Lewis is not going to be that influential there because it's a huge retail base. So, okay. We have one more subject I want to get through, which I think is a really fascinating one. And I'm curious if you think we might see an uptick in active managers becoming more activist. And so I've been writing about this situation almost every day. Something's come up about it. Ritchie Brothers, this Canadian company, in its effort to acquire IAA. So the buyer, Ritchie Brothers, is a Canadian online marketplace for trucks and heavy equipment. And the target IAA is a U.S. auto salvage and parts auction company. And it seems almost every day now, one investor is coming out in favor of opposed to the deal. I think I have about, I don't know, 8 or 9 investors have come out publicly, either in favor, you know, with presentations and press releases or against the deal. So very strong support and opposition from a variety of investors. And none of them I would consider, well, maybe two of them I would consider to be activist investors. Most of them are active managers. For example, Janice Henderson Investors came out publicly against the merger. And, you know, they are definitely not what you would consider an activist fund. And I know they came out last year against Zendesk Momentive, a deal that ultimately unraveled. So Lauren, we expected this kind of explosion of active managers becoming activists a while ago, but then nothing happened. So I'm curious, maybe take us through a little bit of the background and what's been going on with active managers and whether we're going to start seeing more active managers launching campaigns and perhaps even contests.
Well, it's a great question, Ron. And it's actually something I just wrote about in my firm's newsletter, the Activista Report. So going back into the history books, I mean, do you remember back in the day when Wellington came out with,
right? That was a big deal. Yes, I remember.
That was a huge deal. So they came out with a one sentence statement expressing how, you know, they didn't support the BMY Celgene deal. And of course, you know, Starboard came out against the deal as well there. Well, that was pretty much the shot heard around the world for defense advisors and boardrooms. I remember I had that case study in all my defense materials for years because it really shook the market. You know, here is this storied, incredibly well-respected institutional investor making its opinion known publicly for what was, I think, really the first time. So after we defense advisors kind of all picked our jaws up off the floor, we couldn't stop talking to corporations about the risk they all face with these, you know, long-only, historically quiet institutional investors who were frankly typically viewed as pretty pro-management, the risk that these investors were going to start shouting their critiques from the rooftops going forward. And so while we defense advisors all waited for the next shoe to drop, ultimately it was pretty much crickets. You know, you had Neuberger or Berman coming out for calling for a sale at Whole Foods, but that was over 5 years ago at this point. You also had T. Rowe come out challenging the rationale for the Oxy board when they took Warren Buffett's money in order to close the Anadarko deal.
That was the one with Carl Icahn was involved.
Yes. Right. Yes. That's right. That's right. But again, that was back in 2019.
Right. That was a bit ago.
So over the preceding 5 years, you know, up until a few months ago, I'd argue, the examples that everyone talked about were really starting to gather dust. Now, what I found so interesting about the early days of this year's proxy season is you're starting to see more voices in the shareholder, let's call it choir, come out and express themselves. So T. Rowe, for example, they came out with a very public statement in the New York Times about their concerns regarding the potential Fox News Corp recombination. And what was so interesting there was that T. Rowe came out before the market even knew the proposed terms from the Murdochs. And as you know, the Murdochs ultimately pulled that proposed recombination. Then also, you know, in this kind of lead up to the proxy season this year, you have what you mentioned, you know, the situation with Ritchie Brothers and IAA. And there's this pending merger vote coming up in the middle of March. And by my last count, I think you have five RBA shareholders that have come out against the deal.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. That's right. Shareholders like Luxor Capital, Janice Henderson, as you mentioned, Bontobel, Deepfield Asset Management, you know, none of whom of these you'd call activist. And you could ask, you know, these two situations that I just mentioned, are they one-offs? Maybe. You know, this being the 2023 proxy season, I'm sure people are going to ask, is this because of the UPC? And I'll say, you know, neither of those situations I just mentioned are director contests. So for these two situations, the UPC is not technically in play. But I do think the mechanics of the UPC, it's going to drive greater public dialogue in these contested situations. So I know we all kind of read the boardrooms across America, the Riot Act, when Wellington came out 5 years ago. 5 years from now, I'll look back and say I was kind of raising the same red flags and there are crickets again. But I really do think the UPC and just this vote dilution risk means that we're going to see more shareholders, activists, or let's call them activated, where they do think that companies need to put in place some type of change. And in order to achieve that, they're going to have to try to drive some type of consolidation of the vote or it's the change they want to see at the company.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I love that term, activated investors. Yeah. I have to keep that one in mind for these active managers becoming activists. And, you know, it's interesting in some of those cases, like the T. Rowe example, I feel like whenever there's a active manager coming out, you know, let's say against a deal, or there's also an activist, right? A traditional activist there as well. And there's kind of it's a 1-2 punch, right? You have the traditional activist pushing for change and then suddenly this active manager comes in, and that really, I think, bolsters the activist manager's case, basically. Like, there was this ex-Elliott guy, Irenic, which launched a campaign against this potential News Corp Fox deal. And so the situation that there's an active manager, you know, supporting their case, I think, helped a lot there. And that, yeah, that proposed merger never happened. So anyways, Lauren, we are out of time. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. So we listen to the Activist Investor Today podcast, and I was speaking to Lauren Gutkovich, founder and managing member of LDG Advisor. Thanks, Lauren, for taking the time.
Oh, thanks so much, Ron. It's been a real pleasure.